Today is Cyber Monday. Millions of people are clicking around the internet for deals on everything from towels to expensive toys. Americans are expected to spend a lot of money this holiday season. The National Retail Federation forecast shows in November and December alone, consumers will likely spend $730 billion. That's about 4% more than last year. Our next guest says the roots of that consumer culture can be traced back to the early 20th century. And yet, she says shopping isn't necessarily as frivolous as we might assume. Tracy Deutsch is an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. She focuses on gender and women's studies, the history of consumption, and the history of capitalism. Tracy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, consumerism doesn't just mean buying a lot of stuff. We really need to understand what we're talking about for the rest of this conversation to make sense. What is consumerism?
So consumerism refers to a relatively modern idea that ever-increasing amounts of consumption are good, both for individuals and also for the economy and society at large.
Okay, so we're working with that idea that it is an opportunity, really. A lot of people complain about the way that consumerism gets mixed in with holidays. Let's play a famous line from the movie Miracle on 34th Street that gets at this.
Imagine making a child take something it doesn't want just because he bought too many of the wrong toys. That's what I've been fighting against for years, the way they commercialize Christmas.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad isms floating around this world, but one of the worst is commercialism. Make a buck, make a buck.
You know, that was released in the 1940s. People were upset about this idea even at that time. When did we start to see American consumption transform?
Well, consumption itself became a pretty central part of most people's lives by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, when more and more Americans were both living in urban areas and also reliant on manufactured goods or goods that someone else had produced for their everyday life. So that's a relatively old phenomena. What's interesting to me as a historian is the flip side of that, which is how long people have been anxious about that fact and anxious about the dangers of consumption.
And how long is that then? Tell us more about it.
Honestly, it is even longer than consumption has been a central part of people's lives. So if you go back, I don't know, almost as far as you can go in terms of modern history and the history of capitalism, people, social critics and economists and analysts have expressed concern that consumption was taking over people's lives and cheapening their gifts and turning people away from more virtuous behavior.
But you point out that consumption isn't necessarily an option for us. We do need to purchase things. Sometimes they're really critical items that we purchase and use. So it's not necessarily this worthless concept. What's your take on that?
So the way I have come to think of consumption is that it's a very important site in many people's lives, and that what we need to do is to understand it as a complicated site in which people express their belonging in groups, their individual desires. They negotiate constraints on their lives, like their financial constraints, and they also work out new identities for themselves. So rather than think of consumption as good or bad, I try to encourage folks to think about it as an important, complicated site, much the same way that we think about paid work.
And your background, some of it is in food and food history. So help us with food as an example of something that we consume.
So food, I think, is a really good way of complicating the conversation around consumption, because food isn't an option. We have to consume food. And for almost everyone, that means purchasing food. And thinking about consumption that way helps to break down the binary between good or bad. The question is not, for most people, am I going to eat or not? We hope. Rather, the question is, what are the constraints on my eating? What do I want to eat? What am I after here? And thinking about, so using food to think about consumption, I think, can help to complicate the way we think about consumption itself.
And better help us understand the reality of it, not this kind of dichotomy that we create.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Tracy Deutsch is an associate professor of history, and she looks at the history of consumption and capitalism. And you're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you realize about consumerism now that maybe didn't dawn on you until you were older? How do you see it affecting your life this time of year or really any time? You can call 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tracy, let's talk about the idea of gender roles and shopping. Early on, there were some pretty set roles. What about that?
So for a long time, consumption was understood as something that fell to women to do as part of their responsibilities for running households. So some of the very first household guides were also guides about what to shop for in different seasons and where to buy it. Obviously, that strict gender binary has broken down over time, although there are still really interesting differences in typically in what men and women are understood to be responsible for. So car ads are more typically geared towards couples or towards men, although not always. And grocery stores are still often imagining their ideal customers as women.
I'm a little stuck on that word expectations, because I feel like often, you know, there are jokes about women who go shopping, and we don't really apply that to men who go shopping. So Right. There's this negative stereotype in there. But what you're saying is traditionally there was an expectation that women shopped for the goods for the family.
Not only was there an expectation that women shopped, but again, if you think about consumption as a necessary part of running a household, there was a requirement that someone had to shop. For most households, in modern history, some of those goods had to be purchased. So the notion that consumption was voluntary was also a way of criticizing women and kind of putting them in their place in a literal way, reminding them that their work was suspect.
And also, you talk about the fact that social critics and reformers kind of blamed working class women for inflation because they were responsible for the family's spending. Paint that picture for us.
Sure. So during periods of dramatic inflation, for instance, after World War I and again in the 1970s, social critics often blamed consumers and particularly women for paying the higher prices. And they argued that if women simply refused to pay the prices, that they would fall. And while that might make sense if you look at it as a mathematical equation, many women shared their frustration at rising prices. Individual consumer action is not, many other economists pointed out, that individual consumer action was unlikely to solve structural problems involving these periods of massive inflation, which were caused by structural shifts in the economy as much as individual consumer behavior.
So if your family expected certain things, you weren't likely to not get them those things because they were more expensive. That affected your everyday life. And especially if it wasn't going to contribute to a big change nationally, you're not motivated to do that.
Well, and yes, I think that's right. And you could this gets at the ways that consumption is complicated and not a cut and dry activity. You could decide if prices went up not to buy something and then renegotiate the relationships at home and kind of bear the brunt of that. Sometimes that calculation made sense and sometimes it didn't. So if you think about consumption as a place in which people are constantly negotiating all sorts of questions, their identities, what their family wants, how much something costs, I think you can start to see how it's a really weighty, complicated, unstable site.
We're talking to Tracy Deutsch. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. She researches gender and consumption. And we're talking about consumer culture in the U.S. as we wrap up one of the biggest shopping weekends of the year. And we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Are the holidays too commercialized in your view? Do you think there's too much emphasis we put on buying stuff in our culture? What about keeping up with the Joneses? Have you ever experienced that or seen people act maybe irresponsibly to try to, be the same as their neighbors? Call 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We continue our conversation about shopping and American consumer culture now. Tracy Deutsch is with us. She's an expert on the history of consumption, capitalism, and gender at the University of Minnesota. She also earned her graduate degree from UW-Madison here in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we as Americans consume too much? What feelings does shopping leave you with? Maybe it's a fun social thing you do with friends, or is there a sense of pressure to always have the latest gadget or the latest coat? What questions do you have for Tracy? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Mike in Shorewood now. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I guess my question for your guest is if you could comment on, you know, we've had this shift in capitalism from this model of production to consumption. And when I was in grad school, we talked a lot about consuming to consume. And now with the internet and the way we can 24/7 purchase, I just feel that we've kind of gone down this road. I don't know where we go from here in terms of our consumption levels. We essentially can't turn it off, and everything's geared towards people purchasing and not really thinking often about the consequences of what they're purchasing, whether that's debt or excess or their ecological footprint.
Mike, thanks for the question. What do you think, Tracy?
So I really hear what you're saying, Mike. I think there's a lot of concern right now around, particularly around the environmental impact of consuming a lot of goods and excessive purchasing, as well as the financial impact of those things. And obviously, those are issues that we have to ask ourselves as a country some serious questions about. To solve those questions, though, I think we have to remember that consumption is about more than individual desire, that when people are shopping on the internet or incurring a lot of debt, there are reasons. And those reasons might include their desire to give a gift or something they feel like they need for their families or the constraints of being unable to move or get to a store. There could be 1,000 reasons. So my point is just that to tackle something like climate change or environmental crisis, we need to remember that consumers are also people who have those concerns, who think about the environment. Historically, there have been many moments when consumers were mobilized to act in political ways. A good example would be an end to child labor, when there were all kinds of boycotts and organized consumption that sought to reach people and encourage them not to produce goods made by children. And that had a real impact publicly and politically. So there's no reason to think that consumers are only as limited as it can look like they are from online purchases.
You know, Mike also brings up this idea of buying and consuming thoughtlessly. Do we see that? Is it just buying for the sake of buying, or is there more nuance there too?
Well, historians are fond of saying that's outside my time period. But but I would say that typically people usually have an explanation for why they're buying what they're buying. Certainly that explanation can mirror the idea that consumption is thoughtless or apolitical, or people just do it to get a rush from the purchase. And certainly that can happen some of the time. But a lot of times the things that people are buying are things that they have a narrative about of what this purchase will do for them, of why they want it, of what it will do for their family or their household. And so I think it helps to think about consumers as whole people who are doing things because they believe that this good will help them in some way.
Thanks again for that call, Mike. You can join us at 800-642-1234 as we're talking about modern mass consumption and what that means for us politically, what that means for us socially and economically. Tracy Deutsch is our guide, associate professor of history, and she looks at the history of consumption and capitalism. Tracy, when we're considering this, there's that phrase, keeping up with the Joneses, that I already used. How does consumerism play into that desire for social acceptance?
So one important shift that happened historically was that people's status started to be marked by the goods that they purchased. And this was something that late 19th and early 20th century economists noticed and talked about. Thurstein Veblen is probably the most famous person who talked about the desire of many people to establish themselves socially through the goods they purchased, and therefore they constantly had to buy new goods in order to keep that status, to keep up with the Joneses, to keep up with their neighbors. That's in some ways a really old and defining feature of modern consumption. It certainly hasn't gone away. I think people feel it to varying degrees, and it can have some unpredictable effects. So for some people, keeping up with the Joneses can involve not sort of buying things but not flaunting them, displaying them in understated ways, or buying things that you think will reflect the values of people around you.
All right. Let's bring Danny in Ontario, Wisconsin, into the conversation. Danny, what are your thoughts?
Hi. Thanks for having me. I guess my comment on the conversation would be living in a little more remote location or rural Wisconsin, it's really been an added benefit for our family to have these on-demand shopping experiences rather than taking, you know, a family trip to the nearest city to buy something that we otherwise could get, you know, next day shipping. So our family has really benefited of getting more valuable time together out of it.
Interesting. So you're not spending time on the road going to those places. Danny, thanks for that. Tracy, what do you hear there?
So I hear, again, a great example of the ways that people's consumption reflects all kinds of desires and values, including, you know, in this case, it's a great example of how buying online can actually, in some ways, increase the time you spend at home with your family rather than traveling to go out and shop.
Sure. What about the relationship between our mass consumption, this consumerism, and power?
So I think that mass consumption is kind of a misnomer because mass consumption, these sort of icons of mass consumption like malls or supermarkets or a place like Amazon, are also things that people have to work to get access to. For a long time, department stores in this country were racially segregated. Many people were excluded from shopping there. And even when they weren't legally segregated, they have often been exclusionary just because of the prices they charge or the different levels that people were sort of shuttled to, depending on their incomes and their interests. So mass consumption, being able to engage with mass consumption in and of itself, is a way of showing, in the United States, a way of showing your belonging, a way of showing your citizenship, and a way of participating in modern public life. It's not something that just happens. It's something that for many people they use as a marker of their authority and their power.
What about how our government systems or people regulate businesses or institute policy? Because I can imagine that if people are buying more, relying on that more, then it would be important that what we're consuming is fair, accurate, right? How do we deal with regulation and who gets the say in that?
So that's been a kind of bugbear of consumer politics for a very long time, because if you imagine that consumption reflects what people want and that it should be a realm of sort of unregulated desire and people just get what they want, it can be hard to justify a regulation, something that puts a limit on what people want. And that's the argument that was used against consumer regulations in the 1980s when many of these were rolled back. In fact, though, there's a very long history to health and safety regulations of consumer goods, much longer than most people realize. Even in the 19th century, localities often regulated the amount that could be charged for certain goods, the quality the goods had to have. So it's not a new idea to suggest that consumer goods need to be regulated. In the early 20th century, the federal government started to step in and pass laws regulating goods, and those have had a really dramatic effect on the safety of everyday items that we often take for granted. I am old enough that I remember the threat of cars that would – the Pintos that famously would explode occasionally – it was regulations that stopped that from happening and stopped manufacturers from being able to pass off products like that.
All right. Tracy, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
That was Tracy Deutsch, Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. We were talking about the rise of American consumer culture and its effect on our personal, social, and political lives.